Well, it is, of course, Monday, and that means it's time for the Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker, St. Mary's University Faculty of Science, Astronomy, and Physics. I said I was going to call you doctor once in the segment. What do you think of that?
Well, it works. It's still weird, though.
It really is. It is weird. Yeah. Well, when you say doctor, people think that if there's a medical emergency, then they call upon you. And you don't want that, right?
Yeah, no. In fact, I have a story about that. That when I first got my PhD, everyone was like, you want to say you're a doctor when you fly, because then if there's a possibility of getting upgraded, you might get preferential treatment. Yes. And of course, that's probably not true. But anyway, so I did that. And then I had one flight when they were going through the list of doctors on board, and they came up to me and said, are you a medical doctor? Mm-hmm. And I was no, sorry. And I'm like, okay, that's happened once. That's never going to happen again. And then literally like a few months later, the same thing happened. So now I never say I'm a doctor when I fly. I don't want to give any false confidence to the crew.
There you go. However, it's got some je ne sais quoi to it, some flair, nonetheless.
It does. Yes. But I mean, to be honest now, I mean, I'm probably called professor more than I am doctor.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Well, I've never been called either.
Okay. Not too late. Go back to school.
Go back to school. 50 years old. By the time I'm dead, I'll have my PhD.
Never too old to learn. Hopefully
there's university in the next life. That's what it would take for me to become a doctor.
You've still got years left.
That's right. So it is Science Files. Of course, we want to get your participation. That's what it's all about. Questions for Dr. Rob Thacker, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. What do you want to chat with him about? Again, pick his brain, see if you can even stump him. 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. Recently, you and
I... Dude, if you have Google, you can stump me. That is not hard.
There you go. We talked recently on my weekend show, and I just wanted to pick this up with you again about the satellite... What was it again? How does that work? Like there was a
The satellite constellation.
Yeah, constellation. Yeah,
potentially tens of thousands of satellites up in the sky. I mean, to put it in context, right? Tens of thousands of satellites on a really, really good night with really, really good skies out of the city, you can see about 6,000 stars. So we'd be talking about literally more satellites than stars, right? So the things that are stationary would be like, ooh, that's different. Why is it staying still in the sky? So that's a problem for astronomy when we look at very large areas of the sky. And we do that. People tend to think of telescopes as just being like things that zoom in on very small areas. But actually, we have telescopes that take very wide angle pictures of the sky, take a big chunk of it. And so in particular, there's one big telescope being built in Chile, about a $1 billion project. And all of these satellite constellations potentially could impact 30% of its viewing time, which would be a really significant chunk of time to lose. So it's generally a problem, and we've got to talk to the companies that are putting these things up there and try and get the satellites to be a bit darker or at least help them to know what level of brightness causes problems for us.
Mm-hmm. What about space junk? Is this ongoing issue,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there's this concept called Kessler syndrome where if you have a collision of space junk, you create lots of smaller pieces which then sort of like blast off in this debris field and then can go around causing havoc basically at certain altitudes. Anyone who's seen the movie Gravity will know the kind of thing I'm talking about. And so this has been talked about a lot. And the thing with more and more satellites up there is as long as they're under control and they have their own collision avoidance systems, which they will have, then they're fine. But if they start breaking and you lose control of them, then you can potentially start having problems. So when these companies are applying for licenses to fly these constellations with thousands of satellites in them, they have to present numbers of the dangers associated with losing a certain percentage of them. Mm-hmm. And so it is a real concern. The one thing I should say that they are thinking now is below about 600 kilometers, then things literally start falling back to Earth on the period of about a decade. So if we had a real problem up to about 600 kilometers up, then, you know, we can wait a few years and it will get sorted out. But higher than that, things stay up there for a much longer time.
Just before I go to a call, Gary, hang on there, get to you in a sec. What about these? We hear about meteor showers and this type of thing.
Yeah.
They must incur some damage from time to time, I would think, some of these really expensive infrastructure.
Yeah. So micrometeorites are a real concern. I mean, even the International Space Station essentially has armor on it to prevent this kind of thing. And I think there's a famous picture of the International Space Station. One of the big windows in the cupola they have actually has this big dent from literally, they think, a paint fleck moving at sort of like 20,000 kilometers, hitting it and making a big dent. So, yeah, it is a concern, and we do actually protect big things like the International Space Station. For smaller things, you kind of have to live with the probability to a certain extent.
Right, okay. How often does that happen? Has anybody lose big infrastructure? I suppose we would know. They wouldn't report that necessarily.
Not from micrometeorites, but we certainly have had collisions between a big satellite and a Russian rocket booster. There was something, a collision that happened in about 2008, 2009.
Okay. 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. That's the number that Gary dialed. Gary, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Gary.
I have a question. Last week I was watching Euro News, and they put a little teaser on before they went to commercial break that scientists had recorded the largest explosion ever in space. But when they come back on TV, they never ever went back to that story. And I'm just wondering if Dr. Becker knows anything about this.
Yeah, so actually this was one of the stories that I flagged for Todd that we could talk about. So this is actually kind of really interesting because this is one of those stories where you read it and you're like, wow, how did we find that? That's amazing. And so it turns out we've actually known about this
thing. That was quite demonstrative, by the way.
We've known about this thing actually for a while. And so this is literally an explosion coming from a supermassive black hole, not in a single galaxy, but in a cluster of galaxies or a big giant galaxy within that cluster of galaxies. And so We've actually known about this particular thing for a while. And the thing is, when we first saw it, everyone went, this is really weird. And there's no way an explosion can have produced that. It's just too big. Mm-hmm. And so what's happened is people have gone back and they've started taking measurements of this, not using X-ray telescopes, which is what we first saw it with, but using radio telescopes to see if there's lots and lots and lots of hot material inside this galaxy cluster. And it turns out, yes, there is. And so we've gone from thinking what we see is like the edge of an explosion. And we now think not only can we see the edge, we can now see all of the hot material associated with it. So people have just turned around and said, you know, although we didn't think it was an explosion to begin with, actually now we think it was. And I've just managed to pull up one of the BBC coverage on this. And I just want to read how big this explosion is to put it into context, because it's absolutely mind-boggling, right? Now, if this explosion continued to occur over the 240 million years of the outburst, which it probably didn't, but anyway, it would be like setting off 20 billion, billion megaton TNT explosions every thousandth of a second for the entire 240 million years.
Wow.
It's incomprehensibly big and incomprehensibly powerful. But it speaks to this point that we've actually talked about. Black holes, as much as we think of them as vacuum cleaners going around, which isn't right, what actually happens is as stuff is falling in, it gets super hot and releases an incredible amount of energy. So black holes don't suck. They blow.
Right. Does that answer your question, Gary?
Yes, it does. Thank
All
you
right.
Very much.
Great stuff. Good stuff. 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. Good morning, Brian.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, go ahead.
That's an interesting
I've always been interested in the way the dinosaurs disappeared, and that's well known. But I think people could be forgiven if that's the only mass extinction. But I understand there was five before that.
Yep.
There was a Columbian called the Columbian mass extinction. Apparently, a meteor killed off all the mammoths and megafauna in North America, and so on. How come? Barely hear anything about this. The other ones, I think they're fascinating, but is there books out there on it? I haven't.
Oh, absolutely, for sure. I mean, every extinction has research groups that are interested in it and the factors that precipitated it. Some of the extinctions seem to take longer in the geological record, and so there, I can't remember which one. I really could. I'm sorry. I'm not a geologist, so I'm not totally up on this.
Oh no, you seem to know everything.
So in particular, there's one of them that takes a very long time, and so people think that may have been related to geological factors impacting changes in the atmosphere. But the sudden sort of incidences from impacts, They're kind of romantic in as much that you can go and look for signatures all around the Earth for essentially material associated with those explosions. And that's why they get people excited, because the evidence for those tends to be stronger than the more gradual ones. But you're absolutely right. There have been a number of mass extinctions. And to be quite frank, we're heading into one right now, as crazy as that may sound.
In which who's being the mass extinction?
The mass extinctions of fauna and flora around the planet, right? Yeah, we're actually seeing a major number of die-offs right
it's
now.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Brian,
I could just ask one very related thing. I understand that in prehistoric times, Cro-Magnon, it's my understanding that the humans, which the Cro-Magnons almost were, there was only 50,000 left of us worldwide. Like something happened. I think it was a volcanic explosion. And somehow, I guess I understand 50,000 is very hard to survive, but somehow we turned it around. Like, did you hear anything about that? Or?
I honestly don't know about estimates of what early man populations were, but I mean, 50,000 as a seed population, if it moves around, it's probably feasible. But the thing, you would have a significant founder effect, that the DNA of those founders would be a very strong factor in the future evolution and future development of those particular societies. But I don't know. I would have to read up on something like that.
Okay. Well, we better smarten up, because I agree with you. We're just wrecking our planet. So.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. When it comes to the extinction of, Rob, of other species, particularly species that we don't see, whatever form it might be, how do you think that the average person does not truly appreciate that, doesn't respect that, and doesn't understand the connectivity that we all have in this world?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you've really nailed it on the head, that we tend to see ourselves as separate from nature without taking into account the fact that all of the water we get is processed via nature, right? People were talking about the Catskills in New York and the amount of filtering they do of the water supply, and realizing that that is incredibly expensive to do by any other technique than just letting nature do it. So we are absolutely dependent upon nature, but we tend to forget that, right? And especially if we live in a city and we don't get out to nature and don't appreciate that, then we lose that connection. And that is a big problem. And it's actually been written about by psychology people as well, that this is something that we have to try and break to get people to realize how connected we are to nature. I mean, at the end of the day, with climate change, the thing that really stands out, even if you don't sort of care about nature, is the fact that food is mostly grown outside.
Yeah.
Right? And food security for the next decades is going to be a huge factor in climate change.
And even with our oceans, all the things that we dump into the ocean, even if it's treated, all the chemicals that go into the water, all of that gets at some point manifests itself back into the ecosystem, right?
Obviously. Oh, totally. I mean, this is, we've talked a little bit about this in the past, but the thing that gets me is we tend to sort of have this out of sight, out of mind approach. And so even with things where you think you're trying to do the right thing, and I'll take sort of like recycled fleece from basically water bottles that have been thrown away. So Patagonia thought, we'll do this, right? We'll take all of these water bottles, recycle all of the plastic into fleece, and that would be a really good thing for the environment. What ended up happening was they created all of these fine little pieces of fabric from the plastic, and then that was being chucked out of washing machines into the sewers and then into the oceans, and the plastic was still there.
Yeah.
Right? And so this is a bit of a concern with plastic, that it's essentially impossible to break down. It just goes down to smaller and smaller scales. So we've got to do something about our plastic uses. There's no question about this.
Okay. 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. We'll continue with your calls and questions for Dr. Rob Thacker. We'll be right back. Continue with the Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker, St. Mary's University, of course, and your participation is greatly appreciated. Give us a call, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. That's the way to reach us. Mike, good morning.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
Great, thanks.
Doing well.
good. Dr. Ob, I've been thinking about the discovery of the radio wave that was repeeting. I think it was every, like,
the fast radio burst, yep,
days.
Yep.
Yeah. I was wondering, is there any way for them to... I mean, when we interpret a day, it's a 24-hour period. So is there any way to look at where the signal's coming from and look at the source of light around wherever that is and try to calculate what a logical day would look like for where that is originating to see if there's any correlation of...
I see what you're getting at. Okay.
Yeah.
So the short answer is... because it's a radio source, we don't have very good localization on it yet on the sky, as far as I'm aware. Now, we know where it is in terms of the galaxy it's in, but where in that galaxy, as far as I'm aware right now, we haven't figured that out. But I would presume that's not a too difficult a thing to do, because we do have radio telescopes that can actually pinpoint very clearly on the sky. So presumably at some point we could find some way of localizing it. But at the moment, as far as I'm aware... Basically, your idea of what you're saying, of like following up with different wavelengths, like optical, X-ray, and so on, that is a good idea. But then when that time scale of 16 days comes along, I mean, we're just measuring the amount of time. Whether that actually relates to some kind of rotation or not, we simply don't know, right? And so we know there is a process that has some kind of periodicity. And we could come up with lots of different models. I could probably think of something where a certain amount of material is falling onto a neutron star, and then after a period of time, it builds up, and then you have a flare event and so on. But to be honest, as yet, we've got to get more information on this. And I'm sure people are doing that right now. And if you just wait maybe as little as a few weeks or months, then we might actually have some better estimates of what the actual processes involved are. But this is not a simple thing to do. I should say that. This is very complicated. The data is still comparatively sparse, and so it's one of those things that's going to evolve at the speed of science, not social media.
Okay. Okay, and thank you very much. And I'm not sure if people know, but I listen to a program called The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Okay.
And Dr. Rob, I don't know if you've listened to it. It's
nope.
Brian Cox and Robert Ince in the
okay.
UK.
Yeah.
It's a podcast, and it's just a wonderful science mixed with comedy program, and it talks about all sorts of scientific topics, and it's great. And this program that you guys run every week is great. So I just want to say thanks.
Thanks
Mike.
For that. Yeah.
Appreciate it very much. 902-405-6000. We're heading to the bottom of the hour. Before I get into another call, I'm going to read a question that I received on Facebook. Jonathan sends it along. Says, when I'm sitting on the couch and I look out the window and see the moon coming from the trees, how fast is that moving? I don't know if you can answer that. And also, I heard that every star is bigger than the moon. They just seem small because they are so far away. And that is true. Even
that
I
is
know
absolutely
that.
Right. Yeah. So when you see... When you see the moon sort of like coming above the trees, what you're just really seeing is the rotation of the Earth,
mm-hmm,
right?
Exactly.
There is a little bit of the motion of the moon as well, obviously, but all you're really seeing is the Earth rotating around, and that's the speed, as it were, that you're seeing. So obviously once a day we kind of rotate around and the moon comes back approximately. It's not exactly at the same point, but roughly speaking, it gets back to the same place. So there's no sort of like... physical speed, a linear speed, as we would call it. So it's just a rotational speed. And in terms, if you want to talk about this, the light, well, that's moving at the speed of light,
mm-hmm,
to get to you.
Exactly.
Of course.
So it's 225,000 miles away, the moon. Is that accurate?
It's, I remember it was about 360,000 kilometers.
And stars are billions, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Stars are much, 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 much further, other than our sun. But even our sun is a lot bigger than the moon. It's literally, what is it, 1.5 million kilometers in diameter,
yeah,
whereas
exactly.
the moon is like 3,000 or something
right.
like that.
What do you think of going back to the moon, just before we end this?
Sure, there's a lot of things that we can learn by going back to the moon, but we have been there before.
Mm-hmm.
But as a staging post for going to, say, someone like Mars, learning about traveling in deep space, I think that's a reasonable thing
right.
to do.
Okay. 902-405-6000. I got a couple people on the line. I'm going to get to you again. 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. Your questions, comments for Dr. Rob Thacker. We'll continue with the Science Files after the news. right, we got Aerosmith cranking out. We should just play this song, the whole thing. No, we'll get to the we'll get to the science files. What do you think, Rob? Are you an Aerosmith fan? Back in the saddle? Not really, eh?
I'm not a huge. I mean, they were okay. I'm not a huge fan of Aerosmith.
Not like the Stones, eh?
I'm not really a big fan of the Stones. Oh, is that right? No, okay. I was kind of into more progressive kind of rock.
Oh, is that right, eh? Yeah. More introspective stuff.
Well, so my favorite band when I was a kid is probably someone you probably haven't heard, a band called Marillion. And I really like those.
I might have heard Marillion. You know, progressive music, not to digress here, I appreciate what it is, but it just seems to be a little too hectic and chaotic.
Well, for some people, they think it's a bit overblown. But anyway, no, it was. So, I mean, I can't. Aerosmith, they had a few good tunes.
Probably the closest I've brushed up against prog rock would be, of course, Rush.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. Kings of prog rock, as
that's
it were.
Right. Yeah. Okay, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. It is the Science Files. We are taking your questions. And Rick, go ahead with your question.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Rick.
Hey, this morning, you know, as everybody was basking in the glow of the earthquake here, Tim Bousquet had a real interesting article, and... he says that, I could even quote him here, that it was probably not anything that anyone could have heard, and he suggested that possibly it was a meteor exploding.
Oh, I thought he was going to try and spin it into a political controversy of some type, Rick. I thought that's what you were going with this.
Well, no. And, I mean, look.
Stephen Harper came to Nova Scotia and created it.
Boom.
But I could read you what he said.
It's okay, Rick. I've seen it. So,
you've seen it? Okay, good.
Yeah, I think Tim was a little bit off base on this. Let's put it that way. I mean, it's certainly true.
Stick to politics, Tim.
To be fair, like, Tim does a lot of good reporting. And so, but in this particular case, jumping to the conclusion that it was some kind of airburst event is probably not going to help, because for an airburst event to be that loud, there's going to be brightness. Even with cloud cover, people will see a flash.
That's right? What I thought.
So, no, it didn't work. And the geological explanation is pretty sound. I mean, the whole area around us, right, from here all the way across Quebec, everywhere, all the way to the West Coast. I mean, we're all rebounding from being under kilometers of ice 20,000 years ago. And so there is still a lot of stress that's being released over time. So these small quakes, they're fairly common. There was another one back in 2017 or something like that, as far as I'm aware. So this is not unusual. And the whole explanation for why there was a boom from something that was fairly shallow is also completely reasonable. If it had been deeper, then we probably wouldn't have felt it. But the higher up it was, the more the high frequencies get to the surface and create this boom. So it's actually not completely unreasonable.
One last quick question. 3 weeks ago, I asked you about the output of the sun. And what I did find out, and I'm just going to... I'll say this and then I'll hang up, was that the sun has this bizarre thing where the equator... rotates at a different rate than the poles.
Yep.
So I'm just interested to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay, so you know what, Rick? This has actually proved trickier than I thought it would be. And the reason is that we haven't... Basically, people aren't too concerned about measuring the output of the poles. What they're concerned about measuring at the poles is basically the magnetic field configuration, and you know about that. We've talked about that as well. So as far as I'm aware, the best analysis we've done of the overall nature of the output from the sun is actually stuff that we've done from the Earth, which limits us to looking up to about 45 degrees above the equator of the sun. And so up to about 45 degrees, the output is very, very similar. There are small changes, but we're talking less than 1%. So overall, we'd probably expect the thermal output from the sun is fairly similar all around, but I believe the solar orbiter will actually do some of these measurements. The first thing that I know about is the Ulysses probe, and that went and did measurements of the magnetic fields around the poles. So it was a great question, and as far as I'm aware, we're still anticipating very small differences.
Let me ask you, when it comes to collecting all of this data, and for years, of course, we know that countries lived in silos, we know the Cold War, we know NASA and all of that.
Yep.
Do you feel as though it would be advantageous, and maybe we're heading in this direction, moving forward, that we gather this information in collaboration internationally and somehow get to that stage?
I'm going to go dude on you.
Yeah.
Dude, everything is shared pretty much now, right? Yeah. Right? And so, so this is a concept called open data.
Mm-hmm.
And so governments all around the world sort of like realized when a lot of researchers were writing about, you know, you maximize the use of scientific data by sharing it,
right?
And so now we actually share all data. NASA has actually been doing this for a long time. A lot of their data has been public for a long time. You do have a period which is called the proprietary period when the people who took the data get to use it first, but then it gets released. And in fact, we've had a big discussion about the next big space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, which is meant to fly next year. And so with that, we're worried that if we release everything really quickly, then the graduate students who are working on projects may not have time to get to write up the papers. So we're going to continue keeping this proprietary period. But at the end of the day, the data does get released.
Right. Yeah. So this idea of national pride and living in silos, perhaps this awakening of to what you were saying earlier, we're all living in a big house here, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, in terms of the scientific community has been sharing data for a long time. And like I said, you maximize the use of that data by doing that. It really doesn't help you to keep it sort of like quiet and private unless it's something that's of significant national security.
Okay, 902-405-6000, that's the way to reach us. Bob, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey, hi. Bob.
How you doing, Doctor?
I'm good. How are you?
Anyway, are you still there?
Yeah, yeah.
The question is, Bob, are you still there?
Oh, yes. I wonder sometimes.
We're always here. We're like we're the sun. We're always here.
And no. I always come back.
Okay.
Doctor, my question is, how can we trust science? And why I'm asking that question, because when I'm looking at history, and of course, I try to follow everything I can, and my facts on that matter is, for instance, for over the years, science has been criticized, it's been crucified, and everything else. For instance, you at one time in our society would have been probably a priest looking at the stars and that, where your wife in her professional field would have been called a witch. But what I'm getting at is... And I say that.
That's so inappropriate, Bob.
But anyways, the reason I'm getting at it is I just read an article about the Harper government controlling science.
Yeah.
And it was insulting to all science that they were still there. So because of religion, because of politics, and because of big business, where can we really, or what can we really trust out there?
Okay.
And how can you convince me that you're there? And that's my question.
Okay, Bob, that is a very, very important question for all of society. And I've been asked that before. My answer is quite long, but I'm going to do the best I can, okay?
Thank you, sir.
So the short answer is why should we trust science? We should trust science because of the way science works. Science is not a collection of facts. Science is not, it's this, not that. It is a process of exploring the world around us, which is constantly being refined, right? So if there is a problem with a theory, then we're always trying to look for a way to explain that and develop a better theory to explain what's going on. So it's a series of refinements. And what makes science work is essentially when we sort of think we've come up with some kind of answer or some kind of theory, then what we try and do is make it very, very clear what the uncertainty is. And we tend not to talk about that when we talk about science. We tend to say, oh, we explain it this way. But every time we have an explanation, there is a bound of uncertainty associated with this. And so, for example, with climate change, everyone says, what's the uncertainty there? And so the latest IPCC report says, to 95% certainty, climate change is caused by anthropogenic factors. And if you're asking me, 95% is really pretty darn good. And so science works in this process of refining the answers, trying to get better answers, developing better theories, and so on. Is it perfect? No, it's never perfect, right? Absolutely clear on that. And in fact, you'll see scientists prepared to sort of stand up and say, you know, we don't quite know about that particular thing. So everyone says, you know, climate change, the science isn't absolutely sorted out. There isn't a single area of science where all of the science is absolutely sorted out. That's just a silly thing to say. There are things that don't match the theories that we have in physics. There are things that don't match the theories that we have in biology and so on. But that doesn't mean we don't have really good explanations for these things in terms of a context, and there are bits and pieces that don't quite work. That's in general how science works. It's never perfect, right? And the hard thing about sort of like making predictions for climate change is the fact you don't know what's going to happen in the future because you don't know what the emissions are going to be, right? So it's very difficult. It's not like a system, say, a group of atoms where they're just going to do what they're going to do because they're going to follow the laws of physics. People are different. So that's the reason why you should trust science, because if there is a different explanation, you can be darn sure there are people out there trying to work out to find out what that different explanation is.
I can trust that theory, but is religion and politics and government, when how much control do they have, and is there a fear there that that
Bob, I'm gonna take that question, because that is again another excellent public policy question. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm kind of interested in. This, so if you go back about 100 years, there was a big debate in the UK about this: how much should government determine how much science is funded and which science gets funded? And what the theory, prevailing theory at the time, was that the best people to determine which science should get funded are the people who understand which science is going to work and which isn't, which is, of course, is scientists. Yeah. So right. That's something called the Haldane principle. We've kind of moved away from that a little bit to people putting the connection between economic growth and developments in fundamental science. And that's made governments more interested in only producing certain kinds of science. I don't have a huge problem with that, but when you get to the point where governments start saying, we want to develop this particular area and put money into this area without looking in detail at the science behind it, then things can get a little bit nebulous and you can waste a bit of money. But these people are elected and it's their job. So if you're a scientist and you want to do policy, go and get into politics, go and get elected, and then get involved that way. That's what I say.
Bob, thanks for the call and the great question. I appreciate it very much. 902-405-6000, 877-801-8255. We'll continue with your calls for Rob when we come back. All right. The Science Files continues with Rob Thacker, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. James, you sound like you're in a wind tunnel right there. James, how are you doing?
No. I'm good now.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. I just had a question. It was about the earthquakes, but I actually had a better question.
All righty.
I'm curious about how radio waves work. I've had a couple superstitious moments where I was driving down the road.
Uh-huh.
I had a tune going in my head, and I had thought that, you know, it was something that I was just happened to be at the perfect time. I turned the radio on, the exact same song that was playing at the exact same point in time of the song was playing at that moment. I was just wondering, is there any way that the radio waves can interfere with
I know exactly what you're getting at. And so there have been tales of people having fillings that vibrated because of radio waves and so on. I have no idea how true those things are. It would require all sorts of a bunch of coincidences for that to actually work. So in general, my answer to this is not going to be one you like. I'm really super sorry, but there's no known mechanism as far as I am aware, and I always qualify it with that, as far as I'm aware, for picking up radio signals and turning them into brain waves, as it were, or thoughts, as it were, within the human body, other than, of course, having a radio and then listening to it.
Depending on what you're combining with it, maybe.
Well,
it's just like certain times I would be listening to a song, and I think it's just the amount of times I've heard the song.
You've got it, exactly. Yeah. So this is something that happens a lot in our lives, and we tend to sort of want to ascribe it to a higher process. But coincidence really does happen. Like the number of times you're thinking about someone and then they call you, right? You're like, oh, that's a coincidence. I was just thinking about you. But yeah, it's just a coincidence.
How's that sound, James? You think about News 95.7, and there we are.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, take care. Dude, we want to be on your mind all the time. 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. Tom, were we on your mind, Tom? Were you thinking I was going to pick your name?
Yep.
There you go.
Just a quick question. Last time you were on, you were talking about all the new satellites that would be going up into orbit. Have they also added for tracking, you know, near Earth objects like asteroids and that coming towards the Earth as part of that project?
Okay, so all right, let's so with in terms of most near Earth asteroids, we track those optically, right? So we're using a network of optical telescopes placed around the Earth to do that. But in terms of tracking lower Earth orbits, constellations in lower Earth orbit, we do that with radar systems. And so the answer is a number of private companies are now building their own radar stations to do more tracking of lower Earth orbit. And so is that enough to track all of the small bits of debris that we have up there? Probably not quite yet. But there are a number of companies that are moving into this space just because the satellites that go up there will probably have some kind of their own collision avoidance systems. But at the end of the day, as I suggested earlier, some of them may break, right? And if they break, they're literally flying bricks, right? And if you have flying bricks going around, you have some kind of collision probability. And for that, estimating all of those things, we will need a number of radar stations around the globe that are constantly taking this data and giving us the most accurate orbits as possible. That's where we're going to see improvements, getting orbital accuracy better and better. But in general, the stuff in lower Earth orbit versus the asteroids that might be coming, one we do by radar, one we do by optical telescopes.
Okay.
Okay.
And how much are we currently tracking? Used to be back in the 80s and 90s, that was what, maybe 2, 3, 10%?
If you look, okay, so if we look at the stuff that we're tracking in lower Earth orbit, then there's tens of thousands of bits and pieces that we're tracking, right? So that is in the orbital database that NASA maintains with its particular facilities. And I think the data for that actually comes from the U.S. Air Force because, you know, there are things up there that they don't want people to know about, so they pass the data first. In terms of monitoring asteroids, everything, it's kind of tricky, but everything that's up to about 5 kilometers in size, we're pretty certain we've got most of those at the sort of like 99 to 100% level. Even things around a kilometer, the only things that we're really sort of concerned about is stuff that might be coming at us from the sun's direction. Where things get a little bit more nervous for us is when we get down to the sort of like 50 meter to 100 meters to 150 meters, which could do a lot of damage if they sort of landed over a populated area. And so those things, the answer is we're not sure how many we've got. We've got a few of them, but you tend to get them and detect them very late. Right. So that's going to be a tricky thing. But we've got a new telescope coming online in about a year or two called the LSST or Rubin telescope now. And that's going to be the best thing we have for doing those kind of surveys.
OK. And how organized is all that?
So like, this is actually something that we take really quite seriously. Like the U.S. has put a fair amount of money into this and the U.S. Air Force was concerned about it as well. So I think the answer to say is we're looking at it much more seriously now than we were 2 decades ago.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you. Appreciate the call. Ben, you're next. Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Doing well.
Good, thanks, Ben.
Go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, just a quick question here. SETI, SETI's been around for a while.
Yeah.
And I know radio waves, they take, you know, they travel the speed of light. So,
yeah.
I mean, I know there's a lot of scientific information and studies that we can get, but I mean, in all seriousness, do you think SETI's kind of a waste of time? Because if there's like a signal, let's say there is a radio signal,
sure,
that's like, you know, 3,000 light years away,
mm-hmm,
and that's 3,000 light years old by the time we get that signal. And I mean, if we want to send a signal back, I mean, it's going to take at least 3,000 years for them to get it, right?
So, yeah, I mean, that's very true.
What's the whole point?
Okay, so let me I get what you're saying, right? And so if we want to have a conversation, that's going to be really, really hard and essentially, as far as I'm concerned, impossible with another civilization. But in terms of whether we should do SETI, whether we should actually spend money trying to detect these signals, my own view is that if we did find something, that would be so incredible, even if we can't communicate back, I don't care. Right. If we did find evidence of another alien civilization, which could be extinct now, as you said, like they may have blown themselves up after 3,000 years, who knows? But just finding that would be amazing. And the truth is, we don't spend that much money on SETI projects. In fact, the government doesn't spend very much on that at all. It's very, very difficult to get money from the government to do SETI. Most of it's funded by private enterprise, basically people who become philanthropists and give money to it.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I would just see, like, maybe they could focus more on our own galaxy or our own little section of the galaxy. You know what I mean? Or
Yeah. The short answer is we pretty much do. Right. We pretty much do that anyway, because it always makes sense to look in your local neighborhood because the signals are going to be stronger.
Ben, I got to get to one other. Great. Thanks for the great question.
Okay.
Okay. Take care. Sean, you're going to have the last question of the day for Dr. Rob. Go ahead.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay. Hi, Doc. It's a silly question because I have kids.
Okay.
So if force equals mass times acceleration, and acceleration is speed times time, can we use the force measured in an earthquake to measure how long it took the tectonic plates to move around?
Wow, that put my brain in a cramp, I'll tell you that.
In this particular case, what you've got to remember is it's speed divided by time. Right?
Divided by time, forgive me.
Yeah, exactly. So it's meters per second. And so the short answer is you could probably work out from the amount of energy released how much of movement there was, but it wouldn't be a very significant movement, that's for sure.
No, it's like billions of years since Pangaea or whatever it was. I was just curious because I have an 11-year-old, and you get a lot of questions.
That's good. That's good. Stay curious.
Thanks, Sean. You got it. So the as far as fault, I know that's not your expertise, though, but we don't have massive fault lines in this area, do we?
Not as far as I'm aware, not massive ones.
Yeah.
No.
The big one, of course, San Andreas Fault.
Yeah, California's got a number of fault lines, actually.
Right, yeah. And Vancouver, I've heard, is in the whole West
Coast. Well, the whole Pacific Rim area is an issue, yeah.
Yeah, tsunamis are potentially always
a like
real
Hawaii,
challenge.
If you're right in the middle of the Pacific, so it's coming at you from all directions.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So anything else that you want to direct anybody to, anything you're working on or anything like that? We don't give you a chance to plug your stuff very often.
Well, not my stuff, but I do want to say... we've been concerned about antibiotics. This is not related to coronavirus. This is for antibiotics for bacteria. And so a team has just used AI techniques to find from a whole digital library of chemical compounds, things that might be good antibiotics. And that's a really interesting and a new result. So they've actually developed one new antibiotic called Halicin from HAL from 2001.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. A real distinct pleasure as always, Rob. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it very much.
Always fun and great questions. Thanks, everyone.
Okay. And Dr. Rob Thacker, of course, will be back next week with Rick. He does this each and every Monday. And the Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker, and a big thanks to him. So we will now open the phone lines up to find out what's on your mind. It's Manic Monday. 902-405-6000 is the way to reach us, or 877-801-8255. We'll be taking your calls after the news break.